So the loud torrent and the whirlwinds roar, but bind him to his native mountains more. Oliver Goldsmith. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank you all for joining me this week. I appreciate the support. Please like, rate, download, subscribe, all that kind of good stuff. And I do want to go ahead and apologize for not having an episode last week. I fully plan on making one, but when I got back Sunday from Thanksgiving, I was exhausted, figured I'd take a little nap, and I ended up sleeping to very late in the evening. Actually, it was closer to morning, so I did not have time to record, and this past week has just been too busy coming back. So, apology for that. I'm going to try and have a longer episode for you guys this week, Do apologize, there wasn't a new episode last week. So if you're a returning listener, thank you all, as always. And if you're a newcomer, I appreciate you too. I hope you will enjoy and peruse the backlog of episodes. Now this week, we will be continuing our look at Neolithic Italy post-cardial wear culture up to about 4000 BC, BCE, whichever of those you prefer. And I'm going to try and get as much done in Italy as I can. We might finish it up this week. It'll depend, but we'll just have to wait and see. However, I did have one question to answer first, and it does concern Italy, or at least Italian islands, or at least islands today that belong to Italy. So it kind of does belong here. And I did have a listener ask me this, and these are in regards to another group of islands. These are the Pelagi, or the Pelagi, if it's the Sicilian dialect, which is, these are basically, that means the open sea islands. And these are three islands, the largest of which is Lampedusa, Lenosa, and the smallest, Lampione. These are all to the southwest of Malta, southeast of Pantelleria. They're closer to Malta, and I'll have a map if you watch the YouTube episode. And I was not able, actually, to get a firm date when people first began to occupy the island. And it doesn't appear that there is a definitive date. There have been small bits of evidence that people using stone tools visited the island, but the tools are so rough and degraded, it's hard to kind of place them on a timeline of when the island may have first been visited. So it's really impossible to say when they were first occupied, at least from what I've been able to read in English. But there's really only evidence of long-term or semi-permanent or permanent settlements showing up after the late copper / early bronze age. You know, it's possible the islands were used for people making long journey trips before then, maybe as a place to rest or maybe resupply some water or something like that, but it's hard to say for sure. So those are three islands that I did not include because it's hard to say definitively that they were occupied during this period, though I would be stunned if the people who were populating, you know, this area of the Mediterranean didn't at least visit the islands. Now, again, did they stay there? Probably not. Even today, there's only around 4,000 people spread across those islands, so may not be the best place to really have, like, large-scale settlements. So make of that what you will. Now, let's go ahead and move back into mainland Italy. And today we're going to be covering, or start by covering, the middle portion of the peninsula. Now, as I mentioned, I believe last week, or at least the week before, there is a very large dividing line between the east and west of the peninsula, and that is the Apennine Mountains. Now, technically, these mountains run from the toe of the Italian boot to the northwest coast, where there's like a, you know, a more slightly leveler, more plain before you get to the Alps. And the Apennines themselves can be divided into, you know, a northern, a central, and then a southern group. But in the center is where they're wider, essentially. They're a lot harder to cross. Not impossible. Just, you know, it might not be worth it to a person who's just trying to eke out a living, you know, managing a herd or planting crops. So a lot of back and forth travel, at least at this early stage, isn't really worth it long scale or long term. Or I should say at large scale, not necessarily long term, but at a large amount of travel back and forth. It's probably only done by a few people. Because of this, however, you do see a stronger divide between the cultures during this period, and kind of some in the next season as well, between groups living in the eastern and western sides of the Apennines. Now, they of course still have links with the peoples to their south, and the people to the south are probably the ones kind of facilitating trade on both sides of the Apennines. And we'll talk about this more later, but at least the people on the eastern side of the Apennines, where, you know, closer to the Adriatic coast, they're eventually going to be getting their obsidian from the peoples to the south that we covered the last couple of weeks. Also, as you might have guessed, the sites on the eastern seaboard are more heavily populated. That's because they've been populated longer. These peoples have had more times to work their way inland from the coasts where the Cardiumware ancestors had first landed on Italy. And the ones on the western side, there's not as much development, at least in terms of material culture. In fact, there's less, at least I was able to find, there's less material cultures in this region on either side of the Apennines than there was in southern Italy. But we'll go into that shortly. The first of these new material cultures to emerge is the Cagtignano culture. And again, this is on the eastern side of the Apennines, closer to the Adriatic Sea, though it is a very inland site. It's kind of in the foothills of the Apennines. And the name, of course, comes from the type site of Cagtignano, which is a town in the Italian region of Abruzzo. Now, this culture actually began to emerge prior to the final disappearance of the Cardiumware culture. The site was kind of occupied, and they began kind of working their own types of pottery, starting around 5,600. So around 100 years or so before you begin to see the last appearance of the Cardium-style pottery. And they really don't impress too many things into their pottery. It's very well made. It's nice and thick, and they give it a lot of dynamic designs with some very dynamic, bright red or lightish red lines. In some cases, these are very wide lines. In some cases, these are very thin. They've got a lot of different patterns. And in some cases, they even have black line pottery as well, though that's rare. They found a lot less of that during this period. So there's a couple of theories about that, but there's no for sure, you know, evidence one way or the other. Some people think it might not just have been as popular, so they didn't produce it as much. Or some think there may have been like a cultural or spiritual religious reason that might make the black line pottery produced for a specific resource or ritual. But again, this is all speculation. There's also the speculation that maybe the black line pottery is a little bit more prestigious. Sadly, we just don't know. Now, their economy, standard run-of-the-mill early Neolithic stuff. Agriculture mixed in with some animal herding, which, you know, up in the hills, got good pasturage for goats. There would be some area for cattle as well, kind of closer to the valley itself. And of course, you're supplementing that with hunting, gathering, and things like that. Now, unfortunately, I wasn't able to find out anything about their burial practices. However, I did see an article about one skull that had been found. It's of a woman. She was between 40 and 50 years old when she passed. And she had had three head wounds on her parietal bones, one of which was fairly old and had fully healed by the time she had died. But there were two more that showed that they had been healing before she died. They didn't fully close up, so she may have gotten sick during her recovery, or maybe, you know, she had fallen and injured herself. There's no evidence, at least that I read in that article, showing that those had been made with any kind of bladed instrument, so they weren't an axe wound or anything like that. So, you know, perhaps she was elderly, perhaps she was, you know, minding her goats or something and fell down the side of a hill. Who knows? But, I mean, it shows that she was cared for, and that she at least, you know, she was had some type of task or something along those lines that, you know, could result in a head injury. And in some cases, very bad ones. She was injured twice, again, close to when she died. So, you know, it does show she's cared for, at least that she was given time to recover. And she had done that in the past, you know. So, it was a very dangerous life at the time. Even if you are truly a peaceful hunting gathering or agricultural society in the early Neolithic, if it is the case that, you know, they were completely peaceful, which I don't believe, but it does show that, you know, accidents and things like that are, you know, very dangerous at this period of time. Now, they were making ritual use of caves nearby. I didn't see anything specifically mentioned human burials there, but they would make treks to nearby caves in the hills. They were also building their settlements kind of on terraces overlooking rivers and on hills, things like that. Now, after the, you know, the Cardiumware had completely disappeared, you begin to see the expansion of this, Catignano style pottery and settlements expand. And as they're expanding, right around 5,400, give or take, 50 to 100 years, about 26 miles to the north, which is like 42 kilometers. Today it's the modern town of Ripoli. They establish a new settlement following the Catignano, you know, lifestyle and artifact manufacture. And over the next 300-400 years, the exact dates are debated. It could be more time, it could be less. But no later than 5000 BC, the site at Ripoli begins to produce their own type of pottery. It's different from what you've seen at the other Catignano sites. These are much more, I guess, dynamic might be the right word. They have a lot more intricate designs. They mix brown coloration with these cream pots that the Catignano were doing. They paint in both black and red on the same vessels. They will kind of do these intricate geometric designs, you know, with a mix, with like one color following one pattern, another color following another. So they really begin to make a distinctive change from the earlier Catignano style. And this style is very, very popular, and it quickly kind of spreads to the other Catignano sites, which, or I should say, when you get to about 4,900, 4,800, again, the dates vary, depending on your source, the Catignano style completely disappears, and it's replaced by this new style from Ripoli, or at least that's where they believe it started, where the earliest versions of this new pottery style emerge. And this is now the start of the Ripoli culture. So they are existing side by side. There's a cultural link between the two, and there's no evidence of, like, you know, massive violence or anything like that. This is just a slow cultural shift to this new pottery style. Also, during the Ripoli period, you do begin to see new kinds of artistic production expression. The Ripoli make figurines. Some are more human than others, though some are just kind of these abstract, kind of rectangular or square looking. I guess they could be human. They're more obelisk look to me, but they do have like these, they'll do have like these like nodules on them. It could be like a nose or perhaps a body part. And then you just have some that are these rough kind of female-looking figures. And that could be an influence from people across the Adriatic. We know that, you know, those cultures are producing female figurines, you know, for quite a period of time at this point. So this could be something that they picked up from this trade. Also, you begin to see more obsidian artifacts show up from here. And this is coming from southern Italy, Sicily, those areas. Another thing you see begin to become more commonplace around all these Ripoli settlements is most of them are beginning to have moats and fortifications, things like that. Not a lot of evidence, direct evidence of violence, at least in terms of uptick, but you know, it is something that they are beginning to incorporate more and more. So this could be something, you know, that they're picking up from neighbors, or perhaps their neighbors are getting more violent. It's hard to say. This is kind of a period where the weather may have made farming a little bit more difficult. So there may have been, you know, a need to defend food supply a little bit more diligently. You also begin to see more grain storage buildings show up in these sites. They had them in the Caltignano, but they're becoming more and more ubiquitous in the region. They're also still using caves and things like that for ceremonial purposes, the same way they were during the Caltignano culture. Now, starting around 4,400, 4,300, give or take, you do also begin to see more pottery styles similar to those you would find in Sicily and the Lipari kind of island area. And that begins to kind of make its way into this region of Italy. However, as time goes on, you see more artifacts, you know, designed on this style. So they focus more on the reds and the pottery's burnished and things like that. So this is evidence of like as they're, you know, trading for more obsidian, they're also trading for more and more of these types of pots. And the Ripoli culture from about, again, 4,400 to about 4,300 does begin to decline. They don't make as much of their own style of pottery, but they're still making it, and they'll still make it into next season. This culture doesn't really disappear pottery-wise until about 3,500, which is about 200 years after you stop seeing this type of pottery coming in from Sicily and that area. Of course, by that point, it's being replaced by a different culture. And basically, everything kind of in like kind of north central Italy below, I guess, the kind of the elbows of Italy begins to kind of conglomerate into a larger, it's called the Apennine culture, but we'll get to that eventually. That doesn't happen this season, but Ripoli does last until next season. Now, for the western side of the Apennines, now, this is a little bit harder to talk about because there's not really any overarching culture that spreads throughout like an entire region on the western side of the Apennines in central Italy. There are a lot of small kind of, you know, handful of sites that might be tied to a single location, that's a little bit more, important in terms of size, in terms of productivity. And they're kind of spread all along that kind of region. So there's not any one to kind of go over. They're all making their own local pottery, but they're also importing it, again, from peoples to their south. One of the more interesting ones is it's known as La Marmotta, which is in Lazio, Italy. And this is kind of interesting. They're the they are the culture that used the cinnabar as a coloring in the Western Mediterranean. They're the first material culture that uses cinnabar to kind of color their pottery. Most of the other cultures that have red in their pottery, in at least in Italy and Sicily, they're using ochre, which is kind of like a iron oxide, but they're using cinnabar. Now, it's not too important just yet, but when metallurgy arrives, this is kind of going to be an important region for the production of mercury. With those that don't know, mercury is present in some cinnabar veins, so this is going to be kind of a location where you can source mercury from. And mercury was important for use in gilding silver and gold. Of course, mercury is toxic, so we don't know how that would have affected them. But, you know, it can cause, you know, weakness. It can cause poor coordination, memory problems, hearing problems, speech problems. It can mess with your eyesight really bad. So, you know, they were probably having to deal with that, at least at sub-level. That's something that has stayed with people who work with cinnabar or mine cinnabar. That's something that's ubiquitous throughout, you know, every culture that has worked with that material. And that'll show up even in Roman times, because, again, this is not far. Rome is on the this western side of the Apennines. It's not far in the grand scheme of things from La Marmotta. So it's just another hazard, you know, in this at this period and, again, in later periods as well. And unfortunately, that's kind of what I have for the Western Apennines. I couldn't really find too many good sources to talk about. Again, for this period, this is still probably a region that's not too heavily occupied by very many people, at least in comparison to, you know, the south and the eastern portion of Italy. But that's going to change. Obviously, you know, they'll continue expanding their sites and agriculture and all that kind of stuff. But that is stuff for next season. Now, there is also evidence of long-scale trade with places to the north in western Italy. There have been some pieces of pottery kind of following the linear ceramic culture, or the LBK. We talked about them a couple of months ago at this point, but they're the ones that kind of moved up the Danube into Central Europe. Their art style was present in Italy, or pottery made by those people has been found in kind of north east Italy, kind of around the modern area of Venice and Friuli. So some of that is legitimate LBK pottery, and some of that is pottery based on their style. The ones found in, you know, kind of west central Italy are probably just copies of that art style, but that is going to go away fairly quickly. And we'll talk about the LBK again later this season, but that is something else you do see. So they have a little bit more trade land-wise with peoples to their north than you do with the eastern Apennines people. They're doing most of their trade to the south and via the sea, or the Adriatic Sea to the east. Though, of course, there are, you know, sub-instances of them doing trade to their north as well. But you don't see nearly as many of those type of artifacts in the eastern side of the Apennines, at least from what I've read. Now, there is one other kind of widespread culture in Italy I want to talk about, and they probably have the most interesting name. In Italian, it's the Cultura dei Vasi e Bocca Quadrata, or the Square-Mouthed Vase Culture, or the VBQ, as it is sometimes abbreviated. Now, they emerge right around 5,100, and they're the ones that do, again, have these direct trade links with the linear pottery culture, as well as, you know, some peoples to the east as well, via the land. And they're kind of widespread in northern Italy. I think initially, when they first emerge, right around 5,100, they are mostly situated around kind of the Venice Friuli area, though as time goes on, they begin to expand to the west. And they're a very long-lasting culture. They last again from around 5,100 to about 3,800 BC, and they're broken into phases. The first is the Finale Quinziano. The second is the Rivoli Chiosa, and the third is the Rivoli Castelnuovo. And these cultures, or these phases, are, you know, they're kind of divided based on changes to their pottery. Their early pottery, again, very inspired by the LBK. They have very small incisions or symbols kind of etched into their pottery. And then in the second phase, you get, they keep these larger spiral decorations or kind of wide curving lines. And then in the third phase, they get, they start imprinting their pottery with different material to kind of create patterns that way. They also begin to create figures that are decorated with the same kind of pattern. They used deer bones, antlers, things like that. And I'll try to have some examples of each of those. Some of the examples of the pottery is a little hard to come by, or it's very poor quality pictures, but I'll do what I can for the YouTube episode. Now, because of where they're located in Italy, the Po River, which is like the large river in the north of Italy, there's a lot of flat land, so they were really able to spread out. They could have more herds than, you know, some of the other cultures in Italy where there's less flat land available. They kind of had to use pretty much everything they could for farming. They don't really have quite as much restriction, so they're able to spread fairly far, basically the entirety of the Po River Valley in northern Italy, kind of between the Alps and the Apennines, is pretty much either their direct territory or territory they're heavily influenced. Now, there is a lot more evidence of violence in this area. At least that's, you know, the primary theory because, again, because of how morbid they are, people may leave and come back and find that there are other people there. And this, coupled with the fact that there's been a lot of bows and arrows found, a lot of polished axes, at a lot higher rate than you see in some of these other areas. So it's kind of thought that there was a larger component of the population that was kind of shepherd-esque warriors, I guess, for lack of a better term. But, you know, that's something that is, you know, typically associated with, you know, the Indo-European peoples coming into the region. But a lot of Italian cultures, even those that aren't firmly, you know, known to be descendant in later periods, you know, a lot of the military service appears to have arisen from, you know, your more agrarian rural communities defending their herds and resources. And, you know, that's something you see in other herding societies as well. There's a very big need to defend your herds, not just from predators, because there are wolves, of course, in Italy at this point, quite a lot of them. But you're also having to defend your herds from other humans because it's easy to, you know, corral and steal animals. So, you know, you have to be ready to defend those herds when you can. So this isn't something that's necessarily Indo-European. I know a lot of people associate that with. Again, that's Maria Gimbutas' whole argument that this was just a peaceful matriarchal agricultural society, but at least in northern Italy, that doesn't appear to be the case, at least based on the amount of weapons found and some of the remains that do show evidence of violence and violent death. But yeah, I think that will be it for this episode. We will be back next week. I don't know what I want to do for next week's episode. I'm thinking of maybe doing southern France and Spain or Iberia. But I may also go ahead and finish off the LBK for this season. But I'm kind of back and forth on which one I want to do next. But that's for me to figure out and for you guys just to listen and enjoy. And I hope you've done so. If you have any questions, comments, constructive criticism, please let me know. To any Italian listeners, I'm sorry I'm butchering your language. forgive my Anglo tongue. But yeah, I appreciate everyone who came out tonight, and we will again be back next week. I've got to get this edited and get the photos ready for the YouTube episode. But you can also you can reach me via email at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can contact me via direct message on X or Twitter. And you can also comment on the YouTube videos. I do try to respond to those when I can. Please feel free to drop a comment there. Also, I live stream on YouTube and on Twitch during the week and on the weekends occasionally. In terms of the schedule for this upcoming, couple of weeks, we're coming up fast on Christmas here. I believe, I'm just looking at my calendar here. So there will be an episode next week like normal. Then the following week on the 22nd, that will be a normal episode. There will probably be one on the 29th or the 5th, but whichever of those doesn't have an episode, or whichever of those does have an episode, the other one will not. Now, I'll let you guys know a firmer schedule, but I am going to try and take a day, at least sometime during that break, to just decompress a little bit more. So, I appreciate you all for coming out and listening. Any comments or, papers or anything you want to send my way, please feel free. I do appreciate all that feedback, and I hope you have a good rest of your day and week from whenever you listen to this. We'll see everyone next time. Peace.